A guest today, Rania Masri, describes herself as a political activist, and that she was when I first met and interviewed her in San Francisco before I came to Mendocino County and began hosting Takes on the World. But besides being an activist, she was an assistant professor and chair of the Department of Environmental Science at the University of Balamand in Beirut from 2005 to 2014. And before that, she was the director of the Southern Peace Research Center at the Institute for Southern Studies in North Carolina from 2001 to 2004. This is Rania's third appearance on Takes on the World, and I interviewed her regarding Iraqi sanctions before the Gulf War, and then again 2 years ago about the situation in Gaza. It gives me a great pleasure to welcome you back to Takes on the World, Rania.
Always an honor to be with you. Thank you.
Well, we have heard a lot about and from Paris since the attacks on November 13th, but little attention has been paid to the attacks by Daesh on the outskirts of Beirut the day before, or the attacks that have taken place in Lebanon since the war has gone on in Syria. You have commented in the media about the fact that this is not just the way this has been reported and misreported, and perhaps you could tell our listening audience about your thoughts about that.
Not only were the attacks, the terrorist attacks against our community here in Lebanon not reported adequately, but nor were the attacks that happened the day before in Baghdad reported on, nor when we take it a day even before that in Afghanistan. And yesterday there was a bombing in Tunis, and I'm not sure if that made the news. And yet at the same time, when there was this terrorist attack in Paris, President Obama goes on national television and he calls the attacks in Paris, and I quote, an attack on humanity. And it leaves us to ask a critical question. Who was human in his eyes then? Because if the attack on Lebanese was not considered an attack on humanity, and an attack on Iraqis, and on Afghanis, and on Nigerians, and on Yemenis, and on Tunisians, and on Syrians, all of which have been happening on a very regular basis, if none of these attacks are considered in his eyes an attack on humanity, and only the bombing in France is considered an attack on humanity, then does President Obama not consider Arabs and other people of color to be human? Are we not adequately human? And I can't but then think about the ongoing struggle in the United States between Black Lives Matter and this racist group called White Lives Matter. It's the same concept. Who was considered human in the eyes of the media? Who was considered human in the eyes of the administration and the government? And whose lives and whose deaths are dismissed or, at worst, justified? And I say justified because when we have mainstream media from BBC to the New York Times to the Associated Press to Reuters use language such as Hezbollah stronghold or Hezbollah bastion to refer to a working class marketplace in Burj al-Barajni that was, you know, destroyed by two terrorist bombings 7 minutes apart to cause maximum casualty. What does that language tell us? We would envision a military barracks. We would envision, you know, as one journalist asked me, were there any civilians killed? Were there any civilians killed? Because that language of Hezbollah stronghold or Hezbollah bastion leads one to think that it was a military barracks. And let's take that a step further. Now with the French adding to the bombings that have been conducted by the U.S. forces, by the Qataris, by the Bahrainis, by the Saudis, by other Arab Gulf communities on Syrians, notice what the language is. They bomb ISIS strongholds. They have not been bombing a city of hundreds of thousands of people. Rather, they have been bombing ISIS strongholds. We never refer to Paris as a stronghold. We refer to Paris as a vibrant city. So there's layers of discrimination, layers of justification that the press has been engaging in that have been strongly supported by the administration that are accepted by a predominantly racist society.
Well, it explains and why the president can order drone bombings, and when we refer to those who have been civilians killed in these bombings as, well, I guess began in Iraq called collateral damage, and humans are more than collateral damage. It took the bombing of the Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders hospital in Afghanistan, because these were let's say, Western doctors providing service for people in Afghanistan, that brought out an investigation about how that attack was carried out. But we saw the same thing just happen, of course, in Yemen, where their Saudis, U.S. allies, carried out a bombing and blew up one of their hospitals. We don't hear anything about that terrorism, a state terror being carried out by the Saudis. It's almost not in our press anymore.
You've touched on three things here that are critical. One, the bombing of hospitals. And when we consider the media discourse here, there's a former CIA intelligence officer who actually had the audacity on CNN to say, and I quote, "The United States should bomb even hospitals and universities in Syria." He took it a step further and he said, and I quote, "Americans shouldn't care about non-American civilians killed." Okay, this was a guess that was presented on CNN. Open justification of massacres and illegal crimes. I mean, an open justification here. And yet, personally, I'm grateful for his comments, because here we have somebody who is presenting the official perspective of the U.S. government. This is the official perspective of the U.S. government, because when we look at President Obama's drone policies, and it breaks my heart every time to think that this was a president that many people in the United States, myself excluded, but many people in the United States thought would be a man of peace, or a man of less violence. But it's under the leadership of President Obama that we've seen a massive escalation of the drone program. And as we know from four U.S. drone operators that wrote an open letter to President Obama that was published on The Intercept and published in The Guardian, they said that these drone operators are inflicting heavy civilian casualties, and they've developed an institutional culture callous to the death of children, where they referred to children, and I'm quoting, as fun-sized terrorists. And this was institutionally supported. They were encouraged to kill children in their drone program and in their drone operators. And when we look at the fact that officially 41 men have been targeted by these drone programs, 1,147 people have been killed. 1,147 people have been killed, which means for every one person targeted by President Obama, approximately 23 people are killed. And in no way am I saying that that one person who was targeted, that their murder is justified either. But we have such a massive exploitation and magnification of collateral damage, so to speak, by these drone programs. And yes, when we look at Yemen, and when we consider that in many cases, the Saudis have been bombing wedding parties and killing hundreds of Yemenis, bombing hospitals, bombing marketplaces, bombing mosques, with the financial and military and diplomatic support of the United States and France. And let us not forget France. Both the French and the American government have been supplying the Saudi Arabian government at a huge weapons profit for both governments, at the tune of billions of dollars in weapons sales. So the massacres that have been committed in Yemen by the Saudi government are massacres that have been supported by the United States and by France, and they are the providers of these weaponries. So it is quite an ugly situation, you know. And just like the drone operators say, that it is their policy of drones that are increasing the environment to support the terrorists themselves.
Well, it's interesting that as I mentioned, Yemen is off the map. When statements about the situation of the people in Yemen by Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International get no play in the mainstream media, they're literally under siege. There's an embargo. They can't get food or medicines into Sana'a, the capital. And you have the U.S., after selling all these weapons to the Saudis, and there's a stipulation when America sells weapons that they're not to be used against civilians. Of course, we know that's just a joke, but it actually exists. But no member of Congress has even said a word about this. And on the other hand, you have here, this is state terror, and the U.S. is providing the Saudis with a kind of intelligence so they can target the Houthis, who are being portrayed as proxies of Iran. It's always nice to to this goes back to the Vietnam War. The Vietnamese were proxies of the Russians and the Chinese. The Sandinistas were proxies of Russia. The Cubans were proxies of Russia. It's always easy to pass these people off and deny them their dignity of resisting oppression.
True. Very true and very well stated. There's always been a boogeyman that the United States has created, and the boogeyman has been created to fulfill a particular imperialist policy. And I say imperialist, again, not with rhetoric, but with the full recognition of what that means. Now the claim by the U.S. government, as has been the claim for a number of years, is that the U.S. government is fighting a war against terrorists, if we're going to take them at their face value, okay? And if we're going to say that the U.S. actually does want to defeat ISIS, let's just go with this claim, and that ISIS is recognized internationally right now as a terrorist force. It has committed terrorist crimes in Tunis, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in France, and elsewhere. So, yes, okay, people are interested in destroying it, with the United States leading that campaign. If that were the case, okay, wouldn't it make sense for the United States to put pressure on one of the main supporters of ISIS, which is Turkey? Turkey that has been providing military equipment to ISIS, Turkey that has provided transport and logistical assistance to ISIS, Turkey that has been providing training to ISIS fighters, Turkey that has been providing medical care to ISIS fighters, Turkey that has been supporting ISIS financially through the purchase of oil, Turkey that has been assisting in ISIS recruitment. Turkish forces also have been fighting alongside ISIS, and I could go on and on and on.
And this is a NATO member. And it's not a secret. I mean, it's talked about in the, even in the mainstream media. But when the politicians start talking, they do not refer to Turkey, because Turkey is critical for them, they believe, in this fight with ISIS. But on the other hand, it is critical for ISIS.
But I want to clarify this.
Yes.
Turkey is not acting alone. It's not that Turkey is doing all of this in the face of the United States and asking the United States, come, show me what you have to offer. Turkey is doing this with the backing of the United States, because this is U.S. policy right here. It's not U.S. politics,
yes,
but it's U.S. policy. Turkey is being supported diplomatically by the United States because ISIS does fulfill one of the objectives of the United States, which is to destroy the region, to break it into further little cantons divided along sects, which is exactly what John Bolton, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, has been calling for in his recent op-ed piece in the New York Times, in which he specifically said, you know, that the solution to ISIS is, quote, to create a Sunni state. And here we have, again, in typical imperialist fashion, absence from his discourse is the voice of the indigenous population, the Syrians and the Iraqis. We rather have another example of voices of empire discussing how to divide and further rule other people's lands, other people's cities, and other people's nation. This is what we have being supported. Again, and I want to clarify this. ISIS is a threat, most definitely. But let us look at what the U.S. government is actually doing and not what it's saying. It continues to support the financial backing of ISIS through its support of Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Qatar. It continues to ignore its own military advice and its own military-funded think tanks that say that the way to defeat terrorist organizations is through policing and not through military power, not through bombardment. That doesn't work. It continues to ignore the advice of other experts that have been saying very simply, block the financial pipeline of ISIS, and it continues to ignore the statements from its own military individuals that say stop creating the environment that fuels terrorism, which is the drones, the military warfare, the economic warfare, and so on and so forth. So either the U.S. leadership is ruled by idiots, or the U.S. leadership has other objectives in mind. That is the choice we need to be making. And I say this very simply, as an individual who carries a U.S. citizenship, who cares for the United States, okay, we need to figure out what kind of leadership does the U.S. want. And right now we're faced with two choices, Tweedledum and Tweedledee, again and again. We're faced with either Trump or Hillary Clinton, both of whom are warmongers, both of whom support further destruction of other people's countries and other people's communities on the backs of the American people. neither of whom is actually interested in defeating terrorism or defeating terrorists themselves. So we need to recognize these things. We also, and I have to say this every time I say the word terrorist, I have to be cognizant of its racist meaning, because all too often it's only said in the media when the criminal is a brown or a black person killing a white person. Then we define it as terrorist. But yet when we look at the white supremacist in the United States, and we actually had an article published by the Washington Times with this title, "Majority of Fatal Attacks in the U.S. Carried Out by White Supremacist, Not Terrorist." Wait a second. Can't you be a white supremacist terrorist? Those individuals that shot out Black Lives Matter in Minneapolis, weren't they terrorists? We need to be using those words for the actions itself. A crime of terrorism is a crime that looks at, that is intended to coerce or intimidate a civilian population in order to get a change in policy. This is exactly what white supremacists are trying to do in the United States, and that is exactly what U.S. foreign policy has been built on for hundreds of years.
Amen to that. Getting back to Turkey, the United States sent these F-16s to Turkey ostensibly to attack ISIS, and then Erdogan used them to attack the Kurds. And it's interesting how President Obama will, or John Kerry will, make some statements that are just like a little tap on the wrist, saying, "Well, we didn't really want you to do that," or they kind of caution, kind of, a little bit more gentle with your murder methods. The Saudis, of course, were instrumental in the beginning of the undermining of the Assad government. I mean, I've said in an earlier program, it doesn't matter what – I've never been a supporter of either Assad or his father, but any government that is attacked from inside is going to respond with disproportional means. And this is exactly what the outside fighters who were funded by the Saudis and armed by the Saudis, they purchased arms in the United States, they managed to get elsewhere, used to get the government into attacking, let's say, Aleppo. Aleppo was not a seat of rebellion. It was a very prosperous major city in Syria. But when the gunmen come into a town, they start shooting at government forces. The government forces are going to shoot back. And that's the intent, to get the government to respond disproportionately. And now we see what's happened. The whole idea from the very beginning was to get the government to respond and alienate sections of the population, cause them to leave. What are your thoughts about that?
The Turkish government has been setting up refugee camps in Turkey for Syrians before there were Syrian refugees. And the Turkish government, we know for a fact that the Turkish military or other elements in Turkey have actually benefited from the destruction of the textile industry in Aleppo and rebuilt those factories that were stolen from Aleppo. They rebuilt them in Turkey. But fundamentally, the issue that you're raising is a critical issue of regime change. What authority, what ethical authority does any government in the world have to call for regime change in any other government in the world? What right does the French government have, or the American government have, to dictate who would rule another country? What authority do they have to do that? And yet all too often, we sit here and discuss which president should rule which other country and with whom we will negotiate, as if we have the authority to determine other people's leaders. You know, and if we are going to be talking about this internationally, maybe the whole world should vote for the U.S. president, since the U.S. presidents have typically behaved as if they do control the world and they do rule the world. Fundamentally, we need to go back to this core concept of regime change and recognize that it is unethical and that it is destructive by design. And we cannot have regime change and claim in any way, shape or form to be a democratic nation, or even to be a nation that is concerned about peace and security. Regime changes that the U.S. government have historically worked for have been built on one interest and one interest alone: how to put a government in place that will serve the economic and military interest of the U.S. leadership. And it's been just that. And because of these regime changes that the U.S. governments have been doing, be it in Central America, in Latin America, throughout Africa, or in this region, we have seen more and more and more destruction. So I want to make that clear. It is irrelevant what we think of Bashar al-Assad. It is irrelevant what we think about the Syrian regime. It still does not give any government in the world the authority or the legitimacy to decide who should rule Syria. That is a decision that should be left only to the Syrian people to take.
The hypocrisy, the double standards that go along with it. By the way, I should say, when it comes to regime change, the American pundits, not just politicians, are very frank about the reason for regime change. They want someone who will be more cooperative and open their markets for American business. John Bolton's op-ed piece in the New York Times reminded me of a paper written back in the 80s by an Israeli intelligence analyst named Oded Yinon, in which he said Israel's strategy for the 80s would be to attack and cause the Israel's Arab neighbors to come apart and be divided into competing religious sects. And we've seen that happen. Now, how much Israel has been involved with it is a matter of speculation, but certainly the Israelis now are very much in bed with the Saudis. They both have mutual enemies. They have the same enemies. Iran has Baleh and Bashar al-Assad. And you notice there used to be criticism of Saudi Arabia in the U.S. press, and this is why there seems to be no criticism in the mainstream U.S. media of the Saudi relation, the Saudis having provided support for ISIS and Al-Nusra Front. As I mentioned, I quoted earlier from Time magazine, refers to that, but it's just like a summary, but this should be a kind of a major investigation. Here we're talking about this terrible threat, and our great ally, the Saudi Arabians, are providing weapons and support for these terrorist groups.
But it's not just the Saudi Arabian government that's providing support. It's also the Turkish government that's providing support and the Israeli government that's providing support. Because all too often, we have the Israeli government has actually been providing medical assistance, be it to Jabhat al-Nusra or al-Qaeda or Daesh in Syria. And we know that they're taking them via the Golan Heights. We know that for a fact. So we have more than one U.S. governmental ally that has openly been supporting ISIS. And we also have the U.S. government itself that has been supporting ISIS, because for the past few years, the U.S. government has been so-called funding Syrian moderate rebels in Syria. And I've constantly asked them, define a moderate rebel. Define who are these moderate rebels. Sometimes they call them secular. Sometimes they even call them feminist. But, you know, we have a saying in Arabic, قُلْ مَنْ تُعَاشِرْ أَقُلْ مَنْ أَنْتَ. Tell me who you operate with, and I'll tell you who you are. And every one of these rebel groups, these alleged rebel groups that the U.S. Congress or the U.S. president have declared to be moderate or secular or even feminist, have gone on record at one time or another as saying that they have fought alongside with al-Nusra Front or fought alongside with al-Qaeda or supported ISIS. All three of these organizations, ISIS, al-Nusra Front, and al-Qaeda, stem from the same ideology, have the same violent tactics, okay, and all three of them are recognized by the U.S. government to be terrorist organizations. So it's not just U.S. allies, the Saudi Arabians, the Turks, and the Israelis that have been supporting ISIS, but the U.S. government itself has been supporting ISIS by supporting those who fight alongside of it, not only by supporting governments who fund it and continue to finance it, but also by supporting those in Syria that fight alongside of it.
And this is fairly well known. As a matter of fact, there was a story in the – it's not just the United States. Also, the British and French are involved in the same way. There was someone arrested in Britain during the summer as a terrorist, but it turns out that the British were supporting the group he was a member of, and so they dropped the case against him. The public is so blinded by the propaganda – and the mainstream media, that a voice like yours, for example, and the information you're putting out will not be heard, and people will have this idea Well, they think of the Saudis, they think of the oil, and they don't think much of – they don't know that the Saudis buy billions of dollars of U.S. weaponry and literally subsidize the U.S. arms industry.
You know, I'm not going to forgive the U.S. public for that anymore, because lie to me once and I will hold you responsible. Lie to me twice and I am the one that is responsible. The U.S. public in the past 10 years alone has – clarify very clearly that we are led by a government that continuously lies to us. So it reaches a point where the U.S. public has to hold itself responsible. We cannot expect that our corporate media that gets financed by the same corporations that are profiting from these wars, that this corporate media will ever tell us the truth. And we cannot expect that our governments that have continually lied to us will suddenly tell us the truth. You know, it's reached the stage where we try to forgive and understand why the majority of people in the United States are being so gullible. But at the same time, we have to say, look, if the government has continuously lied to you, given you lies about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, and then later told you, oops, sorry about it. If Hillary Clinton, who voted for the Iraq invasion in 2003, now calls it, quote, a mistake, and rather than calling it a crime and a massacre and a genocide, but at least she recognizes that it was wrong, why should we trust her now when she recognized that she herself committed a, quote, mistake? And if we don't trust Hillary Clinton, why should we trust the president that continues to support her, President Obama? And if we don't trust Clinton and don't trust Obama based on statements that they themselves made, why should we trust the Democratic Party leadership that continues to bring us more people to the right and to the right, while the majority of Americans are asking for people who represent more issues of social justice? And when we talk about social justice, are we truly to believe that Bernie Sanders is the representative of the left and the representative of the peace movement and the representative of the step forward when he continues to be a warmonger on foreign policy issues, when he refuses to condemn Israeli genocide and Israeli massacres and Israeli killings of Palestinians, and when he refuses to even condemn and stand up publicly in opposition of military warfare in Syria? So the only voice for sanity we have in the United States is Jill Stein and others like her, which then has to force people in the United States to the critical question: for how long are we going to continue to organize for the short term, continue to organize for 2 to 4 years, rather than do what we should have done decades ago, which is build for the long term, recognize that we need a real revolution in the United States, a revolution of political parties, a revolution of economic leadership, a revolution in institutions, and we need to be working together on that. We cannot simply go to the ballots next year and vote for Bernie or vote for Clinton and actually think we are going to be making a transformational difference on foreign policy or even on domestic policy. Really, we've had enough of that. And we, particularly people on the left, need to finally recognize, and not finally recognize, we need to recognize truly the seriousness of the issue and be working with more energy and more commitment together. At the same time, while recognizing the extreme victories that we have achieved, by recognizing the beautiful collective organization of Black Lives Matter in the United States, which can never be dismissed when we talk about terrorism abroad. We can never forget the terrorism at home and the continuous brutality of the U.S. police departments and the fact that we have institutional cover-up of police crimes against unarmed individuals in the United States, particularly when they're Black and brown. To me, all of these issues are connected, and it starts by us unveiling the mask, by us recognizing the solidarity that needs to be built, and for us then working towards a transformational change.
Well said. You know, one of the most disappointing things is that despite the great protests before the war in Iraq, after the war began, it dissipated. And here we have, there was no pressure when the Democrats came to power in 2006 to have an investigation about the war. As a matter of fact, Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, specifically said that wouldn't happen. So even in Britain, they made half-hearted attempts to have an investigation of what took Britain into the war. But here in the United States, there was absolutely no demand for it. There should have been mass protests. But the problem is somehow the movement that we saw in the 60s that didn't have social media, that didn't have cell phones or smartphones or computers, just had door-to-door talking, telephones, meeting personally face-to-face, produced an anti-war movement that the new social media has not been able to do.
I'm not sure I'm going to blame social media for it. There's been many opportunities that social media has opened up for us. What I will blame, though, is the attitude that's generally present in the United States, that a Democratic leadership is our man or our woman in office, and therefore we end up being much more critical to a Republican leadership than when we are to a Democratic leadership. And for me personally, it makes no difference if you are supported by the elephant or the donkey. What I look at is what kind of policies on the ground are you initiating? And as we have seen from Reagan forward, that we have only been given Republican leaders. We have yet to have a Democratic leader in the country since Ronald Reagan. They've all been Republicans when we look at their policies. Okay, so but there still tends to be this tendency when we look at labor union organizing, when we look at other forms of organizing, there still tends to be this tendency that if he's a Democrat, he's our man. At the same time, there's been a massive reduction in voter turnout. There's been a massive sense of voting disenfranchisement. So at the same time that we're seeing all of this, there's also been another kind of community organizing, and a beautiful kind of community organizing. So I don't want to dismiss the efforts that have been built over the past few, past 10 to 15 years, simply by saying that the anti-war movement has failed or has diminished in size since 2003. That is true. But in many ways, I look at Black Lives Matter as an anti-war movement. I look at the American Indian movement as an anti-war movement. And every single independent labor organizer is an anti-war organizer. And most definitely, the victories that we have been seeing throughout the United States on the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, those are anti-war organizers, just as they are peace and social justice organizers. So the protest has shifted, and our analysis of the protest also needs to shift.
Well, that we have a lot on the agenda here, and not... I'm not just speaking on the telephone now, but on the American agenda, because we are going to see a competition of warmongering apparently going on in the presidential election year, in which every candidate will play Trump is playing the race car with immigration, clearly, and we do have a divide in this country. We do have a core of racist, of white supremacist, white racist, who rejected the idea of a black man who wasn't an Uncle Tom being president, despite the fact that his policies were in total line with corporate and the military-industrial complex. His skin color got in the way for them. And we have to kind of find a way to move on, and we have a lot of responsibility
on our shoulders. But at the same time, I mean, I cannot simply criticize Trump for his racism without criticizing Clinton for her racism and Obama for his racism when he doesn't consider attacks against people in Africa and in the Middle East to be attacks against crimes on humanity. And when Clinton does not consider that her support of the private industrial complex is a racist crime against humanity in the United States. So I want us to dissect and look beyond the words of these individuals and look at their policies and look at their discourse and look at their actions. And when we do, again, let me repeat, I find them that they all belong to the same ideology, which is a racist, Republican, steroid-based capitalism that is destructive for all peoples and beneficial only to the weapons industry and to transnational corporations and to everybody else. It's destructive.
Well, with that wonderful last commentary, Rania, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today and Takes on the World. Be safe and give my love to Beirut. I love that city and the people.
Thank you very much. All the best to you all.
Thanks. Take care.